Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indy Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indy Radio, we go from a downtown Indianapolis coffee shop to a Hancock County tree farm. We talk with BJ Davis of Bee Coffee Roasters about a recent Gilmore Girls promotion that had customers lining up before the shops even opened. And we also talk about the upcoming Caffeine Crawl event in Indianapolis. Then we head to Greenfield to talk with Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm about history, pawpaws, and Christmas trees. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indy Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. If you're a Gilmore Girls fan, you know all about Lorelai, Rory, Luke's Diner, and Stars Hollow. And you know the show itself debuted 16 years ago and ran for 7 seasons, creating a huge cadre of devoted fans. And next month, Netflix will release the TV miniseries, Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. So what does this Netflix show have to do with local food and drink in Indianapolis? Well, as a promotion, Netflix contacted coffee shops around the country and provided signage and cups and free coffee to turn them into Luke's Diner for a day. And the fans went crazy. In Indianapolis, both locations of Bee Coffee Roasters became Luke's Diner for a day this past week, and I just had to sit down with Bee Coffee Roasters' BJ Davis to hear about how it happened, the interesting people who lined up, and a few other quirks about one of Indy's most popular coffee roasters.
We got a random email through our website asking if we would be interested in doing a free coffee giveaway event with Netflix and Gilmore Girls to commemorate the 16th anniversary of the first Gilmore Girls episode. And I thought it was a scam. Seriously, I get this random email, and I thought it was a scam. And so Andy and I talk about it, and I said, well, I'm going to answer the email, because if it's true, it'll be fun. It'll just be fun. You know, we're big nerds, and we all watch TV, and we're all kind of into different things. Everybody that works at Bee is a big nerd about something.
So a Gilmore Girl fan thing would be a kind of a good fit.
Yeah, exactly. And I watched Gilmore Girls, and our roaster, one of our roasters, Joanna, had binge-watched it when she was sick, although she wouldn't call herself a fan. But she's watched it all, and several of the other young ladies who work for us had watched it growing up. Of course, the guys were like, what is this? And, of course, Andy had no idea, so he did a little research on Luke, and then he pulled off a really good Luke.
So he wore the backwards ball cap and everything?
And the flannel shirt, and he had the scruffy beard. He did the whole thing. And women kept saying, Luke, can we take our picture with you?
Oh, that's great.
I'm sure his wife loves that.
So it was a success then?
It was. It did not turn out to be a scam. I started posting about doing this Luke's Diner thing, and then one of my friends in Chicago that we buy coffee from, Aaron Campos of Dark Matter, texts me and says, oh, hey, would you grab one of those sleeves? My wife's a big fan. And I texted him back, and I said, sure, I can bring you a sleeve, but you realize that one of your coffee shops is also doing Luke's Diner, don't you? And he's like, oh, no. Yeah, okay, I guess I heard something about that.
So how did it work? So they sent you coffee cups?
They sent us 500 coffee cups and 500 coffee sleeves for each location. So basically we had 1,000 for Indianapolis, We had so many people come. We had people from Fort Wayne. We had people from Champaign, Illinois come in.
Oh my goodness.
We were the only one in the state of Indiana. Some states had several. Some states had one or two. I think there were states with none.
Oh no! So this was a Netflix sponsored promotion, and so they just reached out and there you are. You're Luke Steiner.
Yeah. Yes. They sent us hats, aprons, and no cell phone sign, which everybody took pictures of with their cell phone.
And, that's perfect.
And they had pictures of people holding their cell phones in front of the sign. And they gave us a big Luke's Diner sign to stick on the window and put outside. Of course, downtown, we didn't put it outside because we were afraid it would disappear. Because we didn't have a tall enough ladder to get it high enough. So we had it inside downtown and we had it outside uptown. We got some great photos, selfies of people with a Luke's Diner sign in the background.
So how did it start? How early were people there?
Well, I got here at 6:30, and I think the line was out, and I'm downtown, out the door, around the corner of the building, down Georgia Street. I don't know really how far, maybe almost to Illinois, I don't know.
By 6:30 in the morning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Several of our regular customers were Facebooking and tweeting, I couldn't stay. I'll see you tomorrow. I can't wait that long in line for a cup of delicious coffee, things like that.
So what were the people in line like? I imagine that they were very excited, but what was the feeling?
They were excited. A lot of them were dressed up. I had...
Like characters
from Gilmore Girls. Lots of Lukes, female and male Lukes in line. Lots of Rorys and Lorelais and
like Rorys in school uniform kind of Rorys.
Yes. So I had this mother daughter come in, and I'm sorry, I don't remember where they're from. Although I have her phone number and it starts with 812, so I'm going to guess they were from Southern Indiana. And they came the night before, spent the night at the Conrad, and I think they might have been the first in line. Mom was dressed just like Rory from the series on first day of school. She overslept, and she's wearing cutoffs, cowboy boots, a blouse, and a coat over it. And for those of you who don't know the show, this is not proper attire to take your child to the private school. So that was a comedic moment in the show. And the mother says, oh, look at us. We're dressed like Rory and Lorelai on the first day of school. And I'm behind the counter, so I didn't really see anything, and I'm half asleep. And I look at her, and I go, oh, my gosh, you are. That's awesome. Because they did. They looked just like them. Well, with different hairstyles, but, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Now, how fun is that? Did you expect that kind of reaction when you answered that email?
No. I really thought we'd have a couple hundred people, not... not a thousand.
Is that about how many you had?
Well, several people, you know, bought extra coffees after the 250 that we had set aside for the free coffee giveaway. We let people have sleeves if they bought a coffee or what have you. But we had over 600 individual ring-ins on the cash register. But
now, is that at different locations?
Yeah, yeah. But several of those people bought multiple drinks. So, you know, for their coworkers or whatever. So I don't know how many people, you know, how many drinks we actually made, but it was a lot.
Oh my gosh. So that's very fun, but Be Coffee Roasters, you tend to kind of do that sort of fun, quirky kind of stuff anyway. I mean, you're like the epicenter for Gen Con when it's here, right?
We love our cosplayers. We love our gaming nerds. We have several gaming nerds on our staff. A lot of us are big pop culture fans, Star Trek, Star Wars. When the new Star Wars came out, the entire staff went crazy. And we have like 12 staff members, and of those 12, I think we have two that don't get into any of that stuff. They're just into what they're into. So.
So what is it like here when Gen Con is here? You operate around the clock during that, don't you?
We do. So Gen Con officially starts on Thursday, and it's called the biggest 4 days in gaming. And
every August, right?
Every August. But we stay open late starting Wednesday night. We actually count Gen Con as an entire 7 days for us. But we stay open a little late on Wednesday night, open at our normal time on Thursday morning, and we do not close until 5 or 6 o'clock on Sunday.
Oh my goodness. So this is a steady weekend of just being open around the clock?
Yes, yes. And Gen Con is just huge for us. There's always a line out the door. We've gotten it down to a science now, where we have an outdoor iced coffee stand to take off some of the line. And we've split the indoor line into two. We have a fast lane, and then we have the espresso smoothie pour-over lane.
So now that's, you know, you are right across the street from the convention center. So do you see any sort of that kind of reaction from other conventions?
Nothing quite that big, although the ladies from True Women cry out their convention is pretty huge for us. Those ladies don't like to go to the chains. They like to go to the independents, and they will wait in line for you. The biggest thing to note about Gen Con, True Women, and also what we found with Gilmore Girls is these people are incredibly kind and nice, and they know that waiting in line is part of the deal.
Well, now that's nice, because so you don't have an unruly, angry crowd then.
No. We save those for other groups that I won't mention.
So, you know, Bee Coffee Roasters is into, you know, kind of fun, sort of quirky stuff, including sponsoring the League of Latte competition among baristas. So tell me a little bit about that. Now, the season has just finished up.
Yes, the League of Lattes runs from January to the end of September, and so each month we meet at a different coffee shop or different locale, and we do that because it's not about Bee Coffee, it's about barista culture. We picked latte art because that seemed to be the most interesting thing to the baristas, and if they're working on their latte art, hopefully they're working on their coffee as well. The season just ended, and the way it works is, depending on, it's a scored thing, so there's an overall winner for the season. And part of that is being at each League of Lattes. So if you come to every League of Lattes and you place at least in the top 4 or 5, you may become the winner.
Oh, so you get points for that.
Yes. So the winner for this year was Joanna Thompson from Bee Coffee Roasters. She's currently acting as our assistant roaster, more so than a barista, but she does carry a few bar shifts. And Joanna came to every single League of Lattes and scored in the top 4 every time.
So now tell me a little bit about what a latte competition is, because it's a really pretty coffee cups. Tell me how they make this beautiful latte art.
Well, you have to have a good base, and that's your espresso. It has to have a good color to it, nice crema. And that crema are the bubbles that are on top of the espresso. And then you have to have really good texture in your milk, which takes a lot of practice. And I always tell people that it usually takes a gallon of milk for me to teach you to make a heart.
Does it? Because I've wondered about that. Now I get to judge some of these latte art competitions, and so I'm just fascinated with how they make that. So you have the espresso, and then they steam the milk, right?
Yes. Yeah, you steam the milk, and you froth it, and you want it to be the consistency of wet paint. So if you've seen these cappuccinos with these huge bubbles on them that kind of pop as you drink them, that's not what we're looking for. And that's kind of what I like to call the 90s cappuccino, because it's kind of tastes like cardboard, those big bubbles. But so what we're looking for is a nice creamy consistency from your milk. and it's just the way that you pour it. You, some people think that you're jiggling it really hard in between the espresso and the milk, and you're not. It's a lot of finesse.
Is this something that somebody could figure out how to do at home? I mean, I've got a little espresso maker. Maybe I could manage these pretty designs.
Absolutely. There are a ton of videos on Instagram and YouTube that, especially YouTube, there are a lot of how-tos. And then there are some, if you read better than watch, there are a couple of places that you can find how-tos that are written out, how to make the milk for the latte art and how to pour.
So I should get a gallon of milk and give it a try, right?
Absolutely. The problem with home espresso machines is sometimes their steam power is a little underpowered, but you can learn to finesse just about anything.
We've been talking with BJ Davis of B Coffee Roasters. Stay with us for more on local coffee and the city's upcoming caffeine crawl here on Eat, Drink, and Eat Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Culture in Indianapolis just continues to grow. We have new coffee shops and roasters opening. Just recently, here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we were talking with Andy and Sarah Hassler of Blue Mind Roasting. Well, this next weekend, October 14th and 15th, Indianapolis will host its fourth Caffeine Crawl event. Now, this is like a bar crawl with several routes on these tours that take you to a variety of local coffee shops and roasters for samples and information. I talked with BJ Davis of B Coffee Roasters, one of the event's sponsors, about the city's fourth caffeine crawl and what to expect, as well as what's happening on Indy's coffee scene.
There's a gentleman in Kansas City who started this caffeine crawl several years ago, and what he does is he goes around to a city and he checks to find out what kind of coffee shops are there and what sort of things they're doing. Are they doing something that's just a bunch of overly sweetened frozen drinks, or are they actually making something artistic and interesting? And if there's enough of those in a city, he'll do a caffeine crawl. And he runs it, so he makes all the money off of it. We don't make any money other than what you buy a caffeine crawl from us. But we are a sponsor for Indianapolis, and we have been for a while. So I find it fun and exciting because it gets people interested in what coffee shops can do rather than just walking in and ordering your super sweet creamy drink or just give me a cup of coffee out of the pot, I don't care. We actually like the people who care and who want something a little more interesting. So with Caffeine Crawl, Jason comes to town and he gets several coffee shops together that he can make a route out of. You buy tickets through caffeinecrawl.com and then show up for your first shop, check in, and you get to taste something at each shop.
So it's like a tour then. So you get to do a tour of various coffee shops, maybe some that you've never been to before.
Exactly. Yes, we've had a lot of coffee shops on the tour or on the crawl that I think people had never been to. I know that every year that we do it, I'll see some of the same faces, but I also see a lot of new faces. And people come from out of town to go to the caffeine crawls.
Okay, so now that's interesting too. You know, like the people who came out of town to experience your Gilmore Girls Day. So you get people from out of the area.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Steve Young of Lulu's, back a few years ago, he and his wife would take a day and go to other cities and go to the caffeine crawl. And part of his reason for going was to see what other coffee shops were doing to make his coffee shop better. I would love to do that. I just haven't had time. Or when the caffeine crawl happens at other cities, I always seem to be busy with something either at my shop or on a trip to somewhere else. So,
But that's what this event like this does, is it lets you, gives you a reason, an opportunity to try out lots of different places, you know, similar to, you know, some of the cocktail events or the bar crawl kinds of things.
Yes, absolutely. It's and that's another thing, even with Caffeine Crawl in Indianapolis, I really like going along, even if it's only for a couple of stops, just to see what the other people are showing off as part of their Caffeine Crawl education.
So now what do you typically do?
We've done a few different things. It's always based around tasting. A couple of years ago, we were really crunched for time, and so I asked Greg Wilson to help us out. And because it's late in the year, I said, hey, Greg, let's do something with Wilkes & Wilson and talk about making non-alcoholic cocktails or flavored coffee drinks. And so we did that. And it was awesome because I didn't have to do any of the work. Greg did it all. And then I got a Yelp review saying, oh, we came to Be Coffee hoping just to taste their coffee, and we got these flavored coffee drinks, and it wasn't very exciting. So, yeah, I didn't do that again.
Well, okay, so you got some feedback on it, right?
Sure. But, you know, I mean, honestly, if you're on a caffeine crawl and there's 20 of you packed into my coffee shop, if you want to taste something that we're not doing, just ask.
So what is it about a caffeine crawl that it's important to the city and what's going on here with our coffee culture?
It really shows it off. I mean, for so many years, I've been involved in the coffee industry for over 20 years, and I've traveled to other cities, and I have friends in other cities that I talk to, and I try to keep my hand on the pulse of what's happening. And everybody has always been so far ahead of us. So, as Andy likes to say, we've always been flyover territory. Well, we say that about a lot of things. We say it about food. We say it about culture, everything. We've always been, oh, Indianapolis, there's no reason to stop there. There are so many reasons to stop in Indianapolis now, and coffee is just one of them.
So we've seen a lot of growth lately. It's kind of crazy. I mean, don't you think? I mean, this is kind of surprising when you stop to look at it, how many coffee shops we have now.
Absolutely. Caffeine just opened, Need Hammer, so that's two more downtown. We still have Quills, B, Mojo's, Calvin Fletcher's, Funkyard in Fountain Square. They recently retired, but they sold it, and that is getting ready to reopen as a chocolate and coffee bar with literally divine chocolate. They will still be serving Be Coffee Roasters coffee.
Well, that's nice to know. So there is a... You know, we're getting a critical mass of coffee shops and coffee roasters. Now, address that a little bit. I mean, we've seen an influx of new coffee roasters as well.
We have. And it's good for us to have some competition and to push the envelope. It also, when you're someone who has two coffee shops and then you have people wanting your coffee as well, it's kind of frustrating to not have a salesperson to go out and sell to other people. So whenever I lose an account to someone who has a salesman, I'm always like, darn it, I don't have a salesperson. I can't do that.
So that is one of the frustrations of being, you know, a small shop, you know, as you know, a small team.
Oh, definitely. But as far as the small team goes, I mean, I think that my team, every time they're out and about and somebody says, oh, where do you work? Oh, I work at Be Coffee and we serve the best coffee in town or whatever they say. It always seems like that's a boost for us.
Now, how do you see the coffee culture in Indianapolis progressing? Have you seen growth in the awareness of, you know, among customers, you know, and the level of knowledge maybe that they have?
Yeah, I really have. I mean, I still find myself explaining the pour over to people, but less and less. I started doing the pour over style of coffee back when my business was Be Java, and I was the first one doing it in town. And people would say, oh, I don't want to wait for it, or, oh, I've had that before and I didn't like it. And I would say, well, where have you had it? Well, I had it at Starbucks. Well, you know, I don't know what they were doing to make it so terrible, but apparently they were making it too fast. They weren't letting it extract properly. I don't know. So I would occasionally lose customers because they'd had a bad pour-over cup. But when it's made properly, like so many of the coffee shops in town are doing now, you get a really good, flavorful cup.
So is there something that you would like people to know about coffee, or that you would like them to explore a little more, you know? So it was, you know, for some of those people who just run in, you know, for just a cup of coffee.
Well, honestly, I know that I still get a lot of pushback from people saying that it's so expensive. But honestly, if you're used to paying for Folgers or Maxwell House or U-Ban or whatever you're buying at home, or you're going to the gas station, you're not buying specialty coffee. You're buying commodity coffee. And specialty coffee is more expensive because the farmers are being paid more. We're looking at the whole thing. We're trying to pay our employees more. We'd like for them to have a living wage. And that means that your cup of coffee is not going to be a dollar and an endless cup.
And that's important, you know, to for the sustainability of the whole process from the farmer to the cup.
Absolutely. And believe it or not, climate change is really hurting the coffee farmers. So that's going to cost them more to figure out ways to grow coffee as the climate changes in their area. They're getting a lot more rain. Mexico had a terrible, terrible crop this year because it rained so much in Mexico, and it was a little cooler, I believe. So all the Mexican coffees have been running behind this year, and one of my importing partners from Mexico has nothing to sell me. Paying attention to the roasting, we don't dark roast. If we dark roasted everything, we wouldn't have to worry so much about how it's taken care of in the roasting machine. But we don't. We have one dark roast. We try to get people not to buy it.
Now tell me, why is that?
Well, you know, honestly, dark roast has been around for so long, and so many people crave it. They crave that bitter, smoky taste, but coffee can be sweet and intriguing. It doesn't have to be bitter and smoky. And if that's what you're looking for, I know a chain that does that really well.
We've been talking with BJ Davis of Be Coffee Roasters about the upcoming Caffeine Crawl in Indianapolis. It takes place Friday and Saturday, October 14th and 15th. Tickets are $25 and $30. For more information and to buy tickets, go to caffeinecrawl.com/Indianapolis tickets. On Eat Drink Indie Radio, and for this next interview, I need to mention a segment we did a couple of weeks ago on pawpaws. Well, Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield grows pawpaws and invited me out to his farm to see the pawpaws still on the trees and taste a really ripe one, which I can now report is sweet, flavorful, and nothing like the underripe fruit I sampled a few weeks ago. I also talked with Bob about the origins of his tree farm. And as we drove around the woods, the creek, and through rows of trees, he explained what he was looking for that was hard to find in central Indiana.
We wanted a secluded area. And you can find secluded areas in western Indiana and southern Indiana, but the problem is private property rights are not recognized there. Every coon hunter, deer hunter, ginseng digger, they just go wherever they want. And so you're kind of limited to this area, but there isn't anything like that in this area. And we looked and looked and looked, and we saw an ad in the Indianapolis paper, 40 acres for sale. Cheap.
Bob showed me that farm, which he runs with his wife, Kathy, and son, Nathan. It's mostly Christmas trees, but lots of pawpaws and persimmons, too. And he explains the appeal of a place called Lost 40 and the origins of the name.
I've just always liked wild things, animals, plants, growing. I mean, it's just natural to some people.
And so when you found it, could you see what it could be, even though it was, you know, growing corn or whatever?
Well, what I didn't explain to you, this piece of property is a double section. In Indiana, most of our land is a square mile. That's a section. This is a double section. So it's 2 miles through, and we're 0.7 miles back from the road here. So it's 1.3 miles to the next road, and all that is floodplain and creek bottom, so nobody will ever build there. So you listen right now, you don't hear any traffic. When the sun goes down, you don't see any lights. So we are right here in central Indiana, where this property like this is just unavailable at any price to anybody. We might as well be in the middle of Canada when the sun goes down. We can't hear any traffic. We can't see any street lights. We don't hear any noise. And now I own the property both directions, north and south, and all the way out to the road. So we're protected.
Wow.
I suppose eminent domain could possibly want to build a highway through here, but I doubt it, because the creek, that Brandywine Creek, that makes an S-curve through here, would be very expensive for the county or anybody. That's why it's a double section. Would have been too expensive to build a road through that floodplain.
Tell me about the how the pieces came together, you know, the family that had that, and you bought the one, and then...
Okay, well, I'll start way back in the early 1800s when Indiana was opened up for settlement. Each settler got 160 acres. And they weren't just given 160, they had to live on it, and they also had to pay the government for it. But the way they paid the government was, the way our government fed and supported the army with food then, is each settler got like a little green stamp book. S&H green stamps, only it was a different book. And every time the settler donated a sheep or a hog or timber or whatever, they got a certain amount of stamps. And when they filled the book, then they got title to the land. And the Bustles originally were the ones that settled this land. And they came from Pennsylvania, and the men that came first were killed by Indians and are buried on this place in an unmarked grave.
Now, what year was it when they first came here?
I don't know. I think it was early 1800s. We think, you know, that's not very long ago. Any rate, the rest of the family did come, and the Bustles got the 160 acres. And Daddy Bustle had two daughters. He left 40 acres to one daughter. He left 120 to the other.
You got to kind of wonder why.
Well, maybe the 140 was the good ground, or maybe it was the bad ground. He didn't like the one daughter. I mean, who knows? But it created a feud that lasted several generations. And when we bought this 40, the other 120 was still owned by the other side of the family, and they were mad at us, and we didn't even know them.
For buying that 40 acres?
Nobody would buy this 40 because it was landlocked, and the other side held the key to an easement. And the only way we got it bought and an easement was we agreed to build the road in that both parties could use. We agreed to build the pond, and we agreed to build the bridge. And so they gave us a 20-foot easement. But still there was... tense times, okay? They were difficult neighbors.
Sounds like it.
I'm being kind. Well, finally, that side of the Bustle family, Mom and Dad died, and they had seven kids. And seven kids, of course, nobody could agree how to split it up, so they sold it, and we bought the other half back. So now it's back as one piece of ground again.
But like the original one.
Correct. But we kept the Lost 40 name. And the reason it was called Lost 40 is the family that had the 120 considered this the Lost 40, lost from the estate. And everybody in the Hancock County area knew this as the Lost 40, as it was the place that nobody owned, so to speak, because the owners lived out of state. And it was used as a place to coon hunt and party and burn cars and dump junk. And if you said the Lost 40, everybody knew where the Lost 40 was, at least the local Hancock County population.
Now, when did you buy it? How long has it taken to turn it into what you have today?
36 years ago. So we bought it about 1980.
Oh, my goodness. And you knew what you wanted to do with it then?
No, I didn't. Well, you know how dumb everybody thinks your dad is, okay? I didn't have any farming experience as far as corn or beans, didn't own any tractors. And Dad said, well, why don't you grow Christmas trees? And, of course, not knowing any better, we planted 500 Christmas trees, and we didn't know anything about weed control. And I remember the first year we planted Scotch pine, and they all turned yellow. I mean yellow, like a banana yellow, okay? And the Christmas tree people said, oh, you have to paint them green. And I thought, that sounds whacked. But if you notice, all the Scotch pine you buy at Walmart and so on are painted green.
I have noticed that green paint. I really have.
Yeah. Well, what we got stuck with is an Arctic strain, and the way it can survive in the Arctic is it loses all its chlorophyll and water, and it turns yellow in the winter. Well, so that was a bust. But in the meantime, you know, we are educated now. We have spruce and firs, and we don't grow Scotch pine anymore. But no, it was a learning experience. Everything we did here, we learned ourselves. My wife or I neither had education in it. We just had interest and could read, and we're not afraid of hard work. And now it's turned into what it is.
Well, it's beautiful. Tell me what all grows here, because there must just be so much. It's just so beautiful.
Well, as far as the Christmas trees that we grow several varieties of firs, which are the soft, short-needled ones. And then we grow several varieties of spruce. Everybody knows what a blue spruce is, and a Norway spruce, and a white spruce. And then we grow several varieties of white pine. There's an eastern white pine. That's the one with the big, long, green needles. And then there's a western white pine and a southwestern white pine. As far as the hardwoods, what we grow is everything that's native. We don't grow anything that's non-native. If it's native, we know that it's had 10,000 years to find out it likes to grow right here in this kind of weather, this kind of soil. And the problem is everybody likes a blue spruce, but did you ever notice you never see a baby blue spruce? They won't reproduce here.
Good point.
Because they're not meant to live here. Okay, we can make them grow here, but they don't like to live here. But all our hardwood trees are native ones. And, of course, we had the native ones that were in the woods, and then all the ones we planted by seed or seedling are native trees. And that's all the maples and the oaks and the beech. And then, of course, we've got the persimmons and the pawpaws and all the different edibles that we have here, too.
So the pawpaws are what brought me out here. So tell me a little bit about the pawpaws.
Well, the way we started in pawpaws is we like wildlife. We like raccoons, you know. I mean, what country kid didn't have a pet raccoon when he was a kid? Or a possum or, you know, something. But we like deer and we like possums and we like raccoons and we like squirrels and rabbits. And we got what's called a wildlife packet from the state nursery. And you can still get a wildlife packet today. And they'll send you, you know, 5 persimmon trees, 5 pawpaw trees, and some trees that have little berries for the birds. And everybody should do it. It's real cheap. Less than a dollar a seedling. Like for $25, they send you a packet of 30 trees that you can plant around your property that's for wildlife. And that's how we started in the pawpaws. We got some pawpaws in the wildlife packet. Well, once they grew up and started to harvest fruit, we said, hey, these are pretty good. And now we've saved the seeds from the original ones, and we now field plant them in rows just like people grow corn. But we've had to learn how to do that, too. Because, for instance, pawpaws are used to starting as an under shade tree.
Like and in the woods, so they're shaded.
And they actually need shade. If they're grown in full sun, the first year pawpaw will die. It can't take the sun, it'll sunburn. So we have to shade the first year pawpaws. And then after that, if you give them full sun, they'll grow at a much higher rate than a shaded tree will. And we've also learned that they pollinate very poorly. So we actually got Q-tips and put little bits of honey.
You're doing this yourself?
Doing this ourselves, yeah. Put little bits of honey in their flowers in the spring, and we actually trained the bees to pollinate the pawpaws for us. And the best part is you only have to train the bees once. Each generation of bees will train the next generation to do it. Even though there's not much pollen in a pawpaw flower, they've got it in their little bee brains that there is.
From that honey that you've put in there the first time.
That's right. So we get probably 1,000 times more pollination than what wild trees get. And our trees are wild trees. We've just learned how to feed them good and make them grow good.
Well, how much do you get a year from all the pawpaws?
Right now, we're probably at 500 pounds, and I would say we just started to ramp up in the last few years. I would say within a year or two, we'll be up to 1,000 pounds, and within 5 years, we'll be up to 5,000 pounds.
That's a lot of pawpaws.
It is. We've looked around on the internet and seen what they sell for shipped, and shipped, they bring about $15 a pound, which, you know, I don't know how big the market is, but we're going to find out. You know, and if there is no market, I think, well, hey, it's been a lot of fun, and we haven't lost any money, and I think all the things I've done in my life I lost money on, you know, and this would be kind of minor if it doesn't work.
We've been talking with Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm near Greenfield. Stay with us for more from Bob here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org.
often talk with farmers here on Eat, Drink, and Do Radio, but we had never talked with a Christmas tree farmer until now. We heard from Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield earlier in the show about the farm and the trees and especially the pawpaws. But I also wanted to hear about the Christmas trees. So Bob tells us how he got started, which trees he grows and which ones he won't grow, and about those wonderful trees that smell like oranges.
I have a daughter that lives in the highland country of Colorado. And about 20 years ago, I ordered 500 blue spruce from a nursery, and I got these three trees in there that were as blue as blue spruce, but they had soft, rubbery needles. They weren't prickly like a blue spruce. And I thought, well, what is this? Some kind of a crossbreed blue spruce? And the bark was different color. Most beautiful tree I'd ever seen. Well, those three trees grew up, and I never could figure out what they were, and I looked on the internet, and I asked everybody I knew, and nobody could figure out what they were. Well, I'm out in Colorado, up about 8,000 feet. I think, there's that tree. There's that tree. And I finally figured out what it was. And the only place that raised it was the University of Idaho Nursery, where they teach their students seed propagation and so on. So I bought 500 of those trees this spring from the University of Idaho. And I asked other people, and they said, they will not grow here. Well, you know, all that takes is somebody tell me I can't do it. And we did lose some of them, but the rest are doing fine. And those three I raised for about 10 years. So I know they will grow here, but they might just take some extra care.
Yeah, what was its name again?
Corkbark fir. Another name is alpine fir. They can be as blue as a blue spruce, with short needles like a blue spruce, stiff branches, but they're soft needles, that they're not prickly, and they smell like orange peels. And they're not the only tree that smells like orange peels. I'm going to have to take you and let you smell one. You won't believe it. While we're here, I'll show you this. This is a Canaan fir, and that's our answer to Fraser fir. If you look, the underside of the tree is light colored. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's essentially the same thing as a Fraser fir, but it will grow in our clay soils and heavy humidity. Okay. And they're soft. If you feel them, they're not prickly.
Oh, they're nice.
Okay. Now, for instance, here's a Norway spruce. It's real dark green. And it looks real similar,
mm-hmm.
but if you feel that. That's prickly.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, I want to show you the concolor fir.
Okay.
The concolor fir is another one that grows in the Rocky Mountains up high elevation, and it also smells like orange peels. I mean, people, here's a tree that smells like orange peels, and they're like, what? But, when you're a kid, you know you peeled an orange and called your sister over and said, hey, look at this, and then you squeezed it right in front of her eye. All right? Well, it smells just like that. They told us, at any rate, we were told that Canaan or concolor fir, another name, silver fir or white fir, would not grow here. And they won't grow in low wet soil, but they'll grow on our better ground.
Oh.
Here, I'm going to show you one of these. This is a Korean fir.
Oh, okay. My.
It doesn't look a whole lot different, but the underside is almost white.
It is. Oh, how pretty.
Yeah, and I've seen them as big trees, and they're just gorgeous. I mean, just gorgeous.
Wow,
that's
striking.
A first-year seedling, so it's real light green, but they'll get dark green like that.
Okay.
See, and these are light, but nowhere near like the Korean fir. The Korean fir are actually from the mountains in Korea.
Oh, my goodness.
I remember when we first started in Christmas trees, I called a Christmas tree expert at Ohio State, to pick his brain on what to plant and, weed control, fertilizer and trimming and those kind of things. And he said, well, what are you planting? And I said, Scotch pine and white pine. He said, well, why do that? And I said, well, that's what everybody grows. And he said, that's what I mean. Why do you want to do what everybody's doing, on a market that's flooded already? All right, this is the concolor fir.
Mm-hmm.
Just smell it. That's what your whole house smells like.
Oh, my goodness. It is orange.
It's like citrus smell.
It's citrus. You're right.
And this one, all right, this is an interesting tree. Fir trees do something that pine trees will not do. They do what's called coppice. And coppice means, if you look at this stump, okay, here's where the first tree was cut off.
Mm-hmm.
That bottom branch we trained into a tree, that was cut off. Here's where the third tree was cut off. Here's where a branch is growing the fourth tree. And when this one's cut, we'll grow another tree out of one of these. And hardly any tree will do that, but fir trees will do that. So you never have to replant.
Oh, my gosh.
You just keep retraining the same tree. Isn't that amazing smell?
It you would never amazing. Dream I that. I can't get past this.
I mean,
this
some people
smell.
Like, see, there's another one. That's a concolor fir. Oh. And they haven't really got the difference in the color of the needle. Their big thing is the smell.
Oh, my gosh.
That's beautiful. Something a plastic tree can never do. You know, and the pines, of course, have kind of a pungent smell, too, but nothing like this.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we ordered 500 of these originally. I remember, well, we knew that they would cope us, so we, you know, people don't always cut it right at the ground. They usually leave a few branches, and I would train that into a new tree. And I saw a guy coming up with a whole armload of branches. I said, and they were all concolor. He said, well, he said, I cleaned all those branches off those stumps for you, and he... I mean, the man probably cost us $10,000, but, you know, what are you going to do if you're going to let the public in to cut trees, you know?
That's so hard to take.
Yeah, and so we would have had 500 of these, but I don't know how many that guy got, but it was so many, I just, after I looked a while, I didn't look any farther.
You didn't break your heart.
He thought he was doing us a favor, though. I mean, he really did, you know. Oh. So I couldn't be mad at him. I just... asked him, don't do that anymore.
So how many people do you get during the season?
It's mobbed. I mean, it's mobbed. We can't keep up with it. There's so many people out here. I probably shouldn't say this because now somebody will steal a tree, but there's so many people. We don't know who's paid and who hasn't paid even. I mean, there's trees coming, trees going, vehicles coming, vehicles going. But our theory is if we've ever had a Christmas tree stolen, we don't know about it. So... that means either we haven't or we don't know about it, which is the same difference.
Well, and, you know, if people are coming out to get a Christmas tree, they're probably going to pay for your Christmas tree.
That's what we figure. You know, we never get a bounce check. We've had one or two we had to run through twice, but nobody ever's written us a bad check. And, you know, our joke is that, well, if we were selling drugs, probably we'd get a lot of bad checks. But who's going to write a bad check for a Christmas tree? Aww. Nobody.
So now, when does the season for Christmas trees start? Does it really start at Thanksgiving?
It really does, and people buy earlier and earlier, which is one reason we've had to go to these strange varieties of trees. You think about it, a tree's a living thing, and if someone's going to cut that tree off at Thanksgiving and someone want to keep it up till New Year's, you know, I mean, that's a long time for a tree cut off, even if it has water. But with the firs, they have a lot better needle retention than some of the older type of trees that you know used to be grown intentionally for Christmas trees. And we sell probably 50 trees before Thanksgiving,
really,
sometimes
okay.
as early as the 10th of November, which I hate to run anybody away, but when they come that early, I tell them, be sure and get a fir, don't get, you know, a spruce, because it just won't last. And then our first big weekend is Thanksgiving weekend, that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We're really bushed, you know, Monday morning. We're whooped, everybody. And the whole family helps, you know, the daughters, and we have shakers and balers. And we have some kids that work for us. I say kids. We've got one that started when he was 15, and he's 36 now and has kids of his own, but he still comes and works every year.
Oh, my goodness. How fun is that?
Well, it's a fun job. And usually the way we get our workers... as we call the vocational ag teacher in Greenfield, and we say whenever one kid graduates or moves away, or, you know, we need more, and we say, who do you have that's a good worker that's interested in trees and wildlife and nature? And he always gives us good names. And whenever we hire a kid, usually he stays, you know, until he finally grows up and leaves the country. I mean, our workers stay 8 or 10 years, and Kathy feeds them good. She always brings out lunch for everybody, you know, and we treat them good, too, and it's a fun job. Everybody's cheerful then, and we don't ever ask any worker to do anything we don't do.
So how long does the season go? Are people out here right up until Christmas?
Yep. I remember one time I found a tree cut in the field, just laying there. And I, you know, I don't know what happened, but I guess what happened is probably somebody cut a tree, and then 2 minutes later said, oh, well, let's get this one instead. So they left the one there. Well, so I dragged this tree up, and I set it out and put a for sale sign on it. And that tree, it was late. It was like the 20th of December. I thought, well, business is about gone. We're not going to sell that tree. And so help me, Christmas Eve, we were sitting down to Christmas Eve dinner, dark enough you had to have your headlights on. I saw headlights come up the driveway, and some guy said, "I'll take that tree." I got regular price for it and everything. So, you know, I mean, that's how late it goes. That's the latest we've ever sold.
Wow. Well, it's a beautiful place, and I'm not surprised that hundreds and hundreds of people come out here every year. Probably thousands and thousands.
Yeah, it's probably thousands and thousands. Kathy did sell last year to the Indiana Children's Museum I think it was in August when she did it, 4 great big white pines, and they had some kind of a display that they were real curious about. Well, okay, how long are these going to be before they turn yellow and brown? Because that's what they wanted to show, the difference in how long it took a tree. And we figured they were probably real disappointed because white pine just stayed green forever. I mean, I've cut some down in the fall, and the next spring they're still laying in the fence row green like they got cut yesterday. So I don't know how that worked out. But and then we've had a few people come in April or May and want to buy a Christmas tree. And we think, well, okay, why do you want to buy a Christmas tree? And they say, well, our son was in Iraq or Afghanistan for Christmas, so we have our Christmas now.
Oh, that's sweet. So they're just going to celebrate Christmas.
That's right. That's right. Doesn't happen often. But, I mean, I won't say there's not a month we haven't sold a tree, but there have been many times we've sold trees in the spring or the summer cut for a Christmas tree.
Oh, I love that.
It's a great business. We love it.
We've been talking with Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. For more information on the farm, go to lost40treefarm.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our caffeine-fueled show this week, and thanks also to our guests, BJ Davis of B Coffee Roasters in Indianapolis, and Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.